Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Tough City Radio, your home at the end of the road, drawls the local radio station's DJ in a raspy whisper. He croons the long O sounds, releasing the words onto the airwaves as though they should have a sticker attached that reads, Caution, Fragile. Tough City Radio is a tiny independent station in Tofino, a town on the west coast of Vancouver Island, Canada. It's eclectic in its output. Free from the commercial pressures of nationwide or city-based radio stations, it eschews contemporary chart music and plays whatever it pleases, whenever it wants. Sometimes their DJs cut a song short if they feel it's trundling on too long. Sometimes they'll shift from a southern blues number to an epic psychedelic track. Years ago, I visited Tofino, a small famed surf town, with the intention of spending a month there, but in the end staying nearly a year. "This place grabs you, right?" is what the people there said. Venturesome Ontarians who have traded the Great Lakes for the Pacific Ocean. Restive Manitobans who have fled the vast plains of the prairies for the beaches and tree-blanketed mountains. Disillusioned Albertans who have swapped oil money trucks for beaten-up campervans. The inhabitants of the place are diverse as a Tough City Radio playlist. When winter settles in, the rain comes, as inevitable as the tides. Deluges fall in biblical swathes. Unlike home, though, no talk of bad weather is tolerated unless a particularly destructive storm is arriving. Daily chit-chat relies on other subjects, surfing mainly, ice hockey when the playoffs commence, but seldom the weather. "Will it ever stop raining?" I said to one of my co-workers one November day. We stood inside the door of the surf shop, looking out at the rain as it was slavering from the maw of a massive grey cloud. "We're living in a rainforest. It's bound to rain," he said. He wasn't being sarcastic. He was matter of fact, showing a forbearance towards the downpour that I found unfathomable, yet impressive. "Don your rain jacket, slip into your wellies, and just get on with things. That's the Tofitian way." And so the rain lashed against my sitting room window throughout the winter, and Tough City Radio droned on my small alarm clock radio that, in lieu of TV or Wi-Fi, was my sole entertainment system. After some time, I noticed that I had heard very few Irish acts on the station. I almost grew homesick for Bono's voice. One night early in the new year, my friend Luke, an Albertan who had grown up hunting and fishing, invited me to dig clams with him and his friend Carlos. Carlos belonged to the Tuquat First Nation, an indigenous people whose home reservation lies deep in a secluded inlet of Barclay Sound, an hour from Tofino. The night was cold, but rainless. The tide was low. We were careful to avoid digging on native land, skirting the border and ensuring we dug only in permissible territory. The moon was covered by a pall of impenetrable clouds, so we found our way using torches. After gathering the clams, we plucked oysters from adjacent beds, and Carlos told us that, in the past, warring tribes would use the beds as a kind of torture instrument. A captured warrior would be dragged on his back across the shard-like shells. Afterwards, we brought a portion of clams and oysters to Carlos's auntie, who lived with her husband in a timber frame bungalow on the reservation. She was a petite, curious woman and, before my arrival on her doorstep, had never met an Irish person. She invited us to have a drink with her. Over the hours that followed, we drank several more. I sat in the warm sitting room observing the artwork adorning the walls, eating home-cured candied salmon, drinking cans of Bud, listening to Carlos's many stories. He had travelled a lot. He had recently spent some time gallivanting in Mexico until he grew sick of himself and returned home to settle down, to finally grow up. I nodded along to everything he said. I could relate. Carlos's auntie lamented the loss of a pet dog. A predacious wolf had clenched it and stolen it away to the forest. She was worried now that her other dog would meet the same fate. Carlos told his auntie that he would shoot the wolf, but only if she really wanted him to. For a wolf, he said, was a noble creature. Sometime during the night, I was gifted a wooden mass carved by Carlos's cousin. It's on my bookshelf now, watching over me as I write. Then Carlos's uncle-in-law played the Pogues on YouTube, and the cosy bungalow in Barclay Sound along the 49th parallel suddenly felt like one near the Ox Mountains. It was even further than the end of the road of which the Duff City Radio DJ spoke, but finally, I heard some music that reminded me of home. In the morning, as we drove away on a rutty logging road, the gleam of the rising sun dazzled the water of the Sound. A gentle wind riffled the branches of the Douglas firs. Canadian geese filed by in the bay. It didn't rain that day either. But for the days that followed, the weeks, the rain fell as though the sky had been sundered.
You're listening to Tough City Radio, 90.1 FM. Taking you to your happy place. It's what's happening in your ears right now.
Jack is in love with EVs. He's infatuated. He recently bought a big SUV, all electric, needless to say. This was no ordinary set of wheels. Jack boasted that it had a range of 550 kilometres, even 600. Belfast and back, easy, he said. Unbelievable range. EV drivers are range obsessed. The driver of a traditional car doesn't immediately start to brag to you about how far the car can go before it stops. So when Jack said he was driving to France for 2 days and invited me along for the spin, the first thing I asked about was range. He looked at me. France is coming down with charging points, he said, but we won't need them. We'll get over and back on the charge I'll put in at home. In slanting sleet a few days later in Cherbourg, we disembarked from the ferry and headed for Mont-Saint-Michel, a journey of just under 2 hours. The dashboard battery icon read 95%. Our windscreen and rear window demisters were on full, as was the heater, the heated seats, the GPS, the radio, and, of course, the lights and the windscreen wipers. Jack wasn't hanging about. He powered us down the rain-swept motorway as the onboard map screen showed the nearest EV charging points. Dozens of them. Our B&B didn't have a charging point, and although EVs can be trickle-charged with a normal plug and cable, a process that can take more than half a day, why worry when we still had 61% and were in a country with more charging points than mushrooms? Next morning, after a leisurely start, in a public car park not far from Mont-Saint-Michel, we spotted a charging point. However, two cars were already using the machine, so Jack decided to leave it until we came back from seeing the sights. But after a good lunch, we found two different cars using the machine. "Shouldn't we wait?" I asked. "No need," Jack said. "Come on, let's go and stop worrying." Our battery was at 50%. There's some discussion as to what exactly happens when an EV battery runs out. There's a difference, it seems, between flat and dead flat. "Your EV is not just going to stop in the middle of the road," said an article when I Googled the subject. "The car will do everything it can to get you to a charging point." Ah, that cleared that up then. We drove up the coast of the Koh Tantan Peninsula, checked into our new lodgings and set out to find a charging point. It was 8 at night. The battery icon said 23%. We followed the GPS and arrived at a shopping centre. It helps no one to recite the language used when Jack realised that this particular charger plug was not compatible with his car. So we bought wine in boxes and returned to our digs. Next day, on 19%, wearing overcoats, we set out driving very slowly for Cherbourg. No heater, demister, lights, or radio. Guided by the screen, we detour to a tiny hill village, Les Pieux. It was raining heavily as we crawled uphill and eventually found a rusting yellow EV charger behind the town hall. Many EV charging points won't take your credit card until you first download an app. Standing beside Les Pieux's corroding charger, I rang a number on the box and explained to someone that we hadn't time to download an app because we were rushing to catch a ferry. "No dice, monsieur," a man's voice said. "You must download the app." He then hung up. Speechless, we resumed our journey. Jack tried not to check his dashboard. In Cherbourg, we were the last vehicle to board. The ship's charging points were on another deck. Our battery was at 6%. We headed for the bar. "If the battery runs out, the vehicle will go into preservation mode," the car's handbook said. "Remain calm." Calmness was a challenge next morning as we slunk out of Dublin Port and entered the north bore of the port tunnel on 3%. A terrifying vista loomed, a major traffic incident. Suddenly a robotic voice inside the car began to bark, "Urgent, stop the car, you have no battery remaining." But we drove on as this robot bawled at us and climbed onto the M50 and chugged along for 5 more kilometres until, glory be to God, we reached Jack's house. "See, I told you we'd do it in one charge," he said with a sheepish grin. "I want to save the planet. I really do," I thought as I got into my beautiful, reliable diesel banger and fled. But surely, surely there must be easier ways to do it.
Picture the scene. Boston, September 1912. A busy dock. Men and women bustling about, cases and trunks strewn everywhere. Among them, Eleanor Frost, with her 4 children. Leslie, aged 13. Carol, 10. Irma, aged 9. And Marjorie, who's 7. Her husband, Robert Frost, stands slightly apart, scribbling something in a notebook. The children shout at him to hurry as people begin to gather their belongings to board the huge teeming liner. On deck, surrounded by the vast Atlantic Ocean, Eleanor and Robert smile as they watch the children exploring. There is a new liveliness in their eyes, the hope of a fresh start. This decision, to uproot the family and leave America for a new life in England, was made on the toss of a coin. After 10 days, the liner arrives in Glasgow. It is early morning and the silver light shimmers over the cold black city. On the train to London, the children stare as green fields and hamlets, church steeples and hedgerows rush by the dust-clad windows. They are entranced by the funny way people talk. From Euston Station, the family take a cab to Russell Square. The hotel they have booked is slightly seedy, a bit shabby, but they are charmed by woolen blankets, metal teapots, a lobby that smells of soup. In the evenings, Eleanor and Robert go to see plays, leaving Leslie in charge. After years of marriage, they are holding hands like lovers again. During the day, while Robert searches for somewhere for the family to live, Eleanor takes the children on the red buses. Leslie joins in with the others, saying unfamiliar words over and over until they break into laughter. Wellington, sweets, Piccadilly, pavement. They move into a comfortable five-bedroom house called the Bungalow, 20 miles north of London in Buckinghamshire. There's no furniture, but they make do with odds and ends. They pick up second-hand. And those precious items they brought with them from home, Robert's heavy typewriter, Eleanor's rocking chair, a trunk of books. 6 months go by. There's a sense of settling. Rhythm imposes itself on the short days of winter and on the longer days of spring. In the mornings, Robert writes, while Eleanor busies herself in the kitchen. The children go to school and in the afternoons, they play in the garden. At 38, Robert is an imposing man. But his face has a worn look from the kind of hardships that can drain joy from life. A failing farm. The frustrations of teaching. The rejection of all but a handful of the poems he has submitted to magazines. But Eleanor keeps at her husband to make a go of it now. On his forays into London, Robert attends readings, meets other poets in bookshops, Ezra Pound, W.B. Yeats, and one day, with renewed confidence, he takes his manuscript to a publishing house. The woman who accepts the parcel, bound in brown paper, offers not much hope. He catches the bus home. And then it happens. A letter. It arrives at breakfast. Robert reads it aloud more than once. Eleanor takes the thick, creamy paper in her hands, stares at it, checks the words are real. Happy to publish, it says. Very good terms. We'd like to publish your next four books. There is one final scene. It takes place on a bitter day in February in the second year of the Great War. Once again, Eleanor, Robert, and the children stand on a dock waiting to board a liner, but this time to take them back to America. At 15, Leslie no longer runs around with the other children. She is more curious about her own future. When she dies in 1983, her obituary in the New York Times describes her as an author of children's books and a lecturer in English literature. It also mentions that she was the last surviving child of the great American poet and national celebrity Robert Frost, who had recited at the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. What a lifetime ago it must have seemed to her at the end. The years in England, when her father, at nearly 40, published his first collection of poetry.
Philip Love was the last private owner of Marley House before it was bought by Dublin City Council in the 70s. He was a market gardener, a horse breeder, and at one point the largest tomato producer in Ireland. He's most well known as the owner of the horse Larkspur, who seemingly came from nowhere to win the Epsom Derby in 1962. This is a poem imagining his life in the house. Naming the Foals. It is the darkest time of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, months before the growing season, and I am casting about for names. The birth date is always January 1st. A name must be found before February of the second year. Six names, listed in order of preference, for someone else to decide. Each name, no more than 18 characters, no initials, no trade names, no numbers, except those above 30, and only if spelled out. No name that's already in use or that's ever been named. No words like colt or filly. No racetracks or famous winners. I carry a book for writing down names as they come to me. When pruning back the winter garden, glancing at the clock, pouring a drink. Sudden flight. Traveler's hymn. Blind faith. Praise the painter. Second harvest. Merchant's dream. Constant optimist.
On February the 3rd, 1959, a plane took off from Mason City Municipal Airport, Iowa. It flew into a snowstorm and crashed in Clear Lake, Iowa. The pilot and three passengers were tragically killed. News soon emerged that the three passengers were the pop stars Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and J.P. Richardson, better known as the Big Bopper. This news was received with great sadness by my friends and myself, teenagers in the village of Duyark in County Mayo. We were passionate about the new sounds of rock and roll and pop music and sought out any opportunities to hear it. And sometime later, we were deeply moved by the song Three Stars by Tommy D, which lamented the death of the three singers and placed them among the stars in heaven. The Coral Record Company took a more commercial view and released a record by Buddy Holly called It Doesn't Matter Anymore, which he'd recorded the previous year. This record climbed steadily up the UK charts, getting to number one in late April of 59, where it stayed for 4 weeks, beating off the likes of Elvis and Ricky Nelson. Ireland didn't have pop charts at that time, but for us it was without doubt the song of the summer of 1959. And that same summer, when I was visiting Belmullet for a fair day on the 15th of August, there it was, playing in a little shop which had recently had a jukebox installed. The place was packed and music played all day, funded by teenagers home from England and Scotland with their families. This was heaven on earth to me, up-to-date pop music playing non-stop. There was Elvis with Jailhouse Rock, All Shook Up and I Got Stung. Buddy had Peggy Sue and Oh Boy. Cliff Richard with Living Doll. And Lonnie Donegan with an old favourite called Nobody Loves Like an Irishman. As I walked away from the music, I promised myself I would find a way to get back there. Now, Belmullet was a 14-mile bike ride from home, not a journey to be taken without good reason. A full 3 months later, our elderly neighbour, who had been living alone since the death of his sister, was diagnosed with a heart condition and was admitted to the hospital in the town. I was quick to volunteer to pay him a visit. Sunday was the day set for the visit, so it was mass, something to eat, and I was on my way. First stop was the hospital, where I found our neighbour, all the better for his few days of good care. I made my way from there to the shop with the jukebox. I was relieved to find the place open, as the only light was that coming from the machine itself. The place was empty, in contrast to my last visit in August. But I could see that there had been a new addition to the record selection. I took the 5 plays for 1 shilling option. It had to be Buddy Holly for my first play. I selected It Doesn't Matter Anymore. Afterwards, I considered playing it a second time, but the B-side looked promising. A song called Raining in My Heart. I picked it for my next play and was greatly moved by this sad ballad with its haunting backing music. When the song had finished, I left the shop and wandered about the town for a little while in a private haze, the music still playing in my head. It wasn't long until I found myself back in front of the jukebox for another go. The combination of those melancholy lyrics with Holly's fresh young voice was poignant, all the more so knowing his tragic end. I played Raining in My Heart again and again until my money ran out, memorizing as much of it as I could, particularly lines like, "Oh, misery, misery, what's going to become of me?" It was time to go. I left Belmullet and started my journey home, singing the song over and over to myself as I pedalled. By the time I had cycled the first 3 miles, turning south at Glencastle, it was not only raining in my heart, but also raining into my face. I pedalled on, humming line after line, and by the time I got home, I was soaked but happy. I had my party piece for the next time a group of us would get together, and as it turned out, we all met up on that very same night. Surrounded by my friends, I was the star turn, just like Buddy Holly.
The sun is out, the sky is blue, there's not a cloud to spoil the view, but it's raining, raining in my heart. The weatherman says...
You can never get Ireland right. Don Bosco's anchor from the failed Armada fleet was still stuck in the low-tide shoreline of Inishbofin, so my day trip to the island must have been long before the OPW finally winched it away to some dry dock interpretive museum. The bishop was supposed to have arrived there by boat that same morning at the head of the traditional flotilla, but he came instead by helicopter, which rankled with the locals. The sacrament of confirmation, however few the cluster of candidates, deserved a bit more pizzazz from the busy prelate. School was still in session, so it must have been early summer in the dying decades of the 20th century. Two boys with old-style leather satchels were sitting on a dry stone wall, watching a donkey foal in broad daylight, her grey balloon of slather and mucus on the magnified grass. Across from Cromwell's fort, where monks and friars had perished in a prototype gulag, surfboards lay among curraghs on the narrow strand, and the island priest waded with others into the ebb water, up to the knee bump of his own cassock, to help launch a large clinkered rowboat with an outboard engine. Down in the dry hotel, it was less Liam O'Flaherty and more merrily postmodern. A Munster friend of mine, a former Dominican novice master who had coached Viv Richards' underarm bowling at a Trinidadian college in the 60s, was prayer matting there cheerfully with his sweetheart, a middle-aged medical missionary from Limerick, whom the Nigerian authorities had arrested and deported during the Civil War in Biafra. They were the first enthusiasts to tell me of Thich Nhat Hanh, a celebrity Buddhist monk of mindfulness, in whose name they were gathered in a teetotal ground-floor room among like-minded folk for a breakaway ashram and an out-of-bounds binge after hours. On the quayside beyond, an artist at his easel assessed the reliable sunshine and set to work in his beard and beret. Women in leggings passed him as he blocked in black what seemed to be a shawl, but would now be a stab at a wetsuit or a kneecap on a rigid inflatable raft. Up above in the church, The bishop, God bless him, was preaching on the perils of drug addiction to a sparse scatter of children awaiting the descent of the spirit, the soulful stirrings of puberty, and an expat adulthood in Adelaide or Edmonton. The priest of the parish had swapped his drenched cassock in the sacristy for a Latin lacework and looked crestfallen. A felt pen, bold font note on restoration funds in the porch of the building read, "There is an ulcer of dampness in our church." The writing was on the wall already. But I went outside into a North Atlantic brightness to chat with the helicopter pilot. I'd given up smoking and so stood downwind in the slipstream of his Winston cigarette. He was an Irish countryman who had gained his American passport by military service in Vietnam, flying gunships on air assaults in the Mekong Delta. Sikorsky Skycranes and the Boeing Chinooks were something else, but he was a Huey Hogman and knew the difference between designs as well as Darwin knew his finches on Galapagos. Yet it wasn't all about survival and the fittest. Sometimes in a generous mood, he'd drop a hand grenade near the fishing boats, 100 feet under the rotors, to gift them a surprise catch, and the stunned fish would surface in their silvery multitudes like the miracles of Jesus on the Sea of Galilee. That was his favourite memory. Which is mine? I've given up on getting Ireland right. You can't step onto the same island once, let alone twice. James Joyce, who avoided visiting home altogether, studiously ignored what was happening around Europe, the War of Independence in his homeland, collapse of multiple empires, start-up Soviets, and the Versailles Peace to end all peace forever, to write historical fiction, the longest short story in the English language, about one neutral, nondescript day back in the Belle Epoque, in the antediluvian world of a lost continent, a lost country, a lost capital, Bloom's bomb site of a shelled city that was still under curfew when Ulysses appeared in Paris. The Montmartre beard in the beret was packing his paints as the ferry stuttered loudly, turned in its dirty backwash, and churned toward Cleggan. A Hindu woman in a sort of sari, but no spot on her forehead, told me he was a dab hand who could do a bird's eye view of a cormorant's dive in one brisk brushstroke, even if the sky was empty of everything except the vapour trails of the new Ryanair. There must, in fact, be 1,001 such West of Ireland jetties at large, in loco and online. Suburban chimney breasts, the holiday homes of the new landlord class, and the jumble sale railings in Merrion Square on a mild Sunday breed their acrylic replicas amid a wealth of watercolours, impasto oils, and pastel pencils. If, in among the tick-box fishnets and rubber fenders of the rusty trawlers in these harbour views that have no actual anchorage, you stumble on the great metallic dragonfly of a red rental helicopter, do message me. I sometimes imagine I imagined it.
On this morning's programme, we heard Rain, Clams and the Pogues on Vancouver's West Coast by Matty Brennan. Saving the Planet in France was by Peter Cunningham. The Years in England by Cathy Sweeney. Naming the Foals, a poem by Grace Willents. Raining in My Heart was by Michael Gallagher. And You Can Never Get Ireland Right was by Aidan Matthews. The music was Rainy Night in Soho by the Pogues. Our Friends Electric by Two Way Army, Intermezzo No. 3 Allegretto or Nancy by Elgar, played by the Athena Ensemble, Capeline Dove in a Hirev by Steve Cooney, played by Zoe Conway and John McIntyre, and Raining in My Heart by Buddy Holly. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to the programme on the RTE radio app or find it or any of the other programmes in the series on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.